With spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
March into spring with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered 500 megabits internet for $39.99 per month, plus a $100 gift card and price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with a free modem, free installation, and free Wi-Fi your way home. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and manage user access for all connected devices with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires May 6, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Talk about all the things we used to do. The laughs, the passions, the little Sebastians, the pets we fell into. And we're putting it all in a podcast. Then we'll send it up into the sky. We're calling it Pods and Recollection. Come on, little podcast, spread your wings and fly.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Parks and Recollection. I'm Rob Lowe, along with Alan Yang.
What's up, everybody?
We've got a good episode for you today. This is the famous beauty pageant, episode 3 of season 2. It aired on October 1st, 2009, written by the great Katie Dippold.
Katie Dippold. Old Dips. Dips in the mix.
Great writer. Just a funny, wonderful writer. And Jason Wolliner directed it. How would you describe this episode, Mr. Yang?
Man, I don't know about you. I felt like watching this, it was like, it was fast, it was funny, it was firing all cylinders.
Immediately, the very first shot of the episode, for the first time that I think, everyone is in their traditional places, just on the set. Like, people aren't scattered in different offices or whatever. Like, everybody's sort of in that bullpen, weird area, and Donna's at the desk that she knows, and Jerry is sitting right there at that table doing God knows what Jerry always does. And it just felt like that's what you want. When Leslie came in and announced what was going on, she was announcing it to the gang, quote unquote, the gang. So this is sort of the beginning, I think, of the gang.
We figured out that the workplace comedy should have a workplace where the characters are. So that's that helped, right? They're all in the same place. I mean, it just felt like we're in a groove. And in this episode, we're going to talk about the inspiration for this episode, what it was like to write it, the evolution of Andy and Anne. Why don't I go through a synopsis of the episode? How about that, Rob?
Take us away.
All right. So Leslie's excited to have been chosen to judge the Miss Pawnee Beauty Pageant, a job she takes very seriously. Tom, excited at the idea of judging women on looks, pulls some strings to get a spot on the judging panel along with Leslie. April enters the contest solely for the shot at a $600 prize. Later on, Pawnee Police Officer Dave Sanderson visits Leslie at work to ask her out on a date. While she says yes, she realizes they don't have a lot in common, so she hesitates on firm plans. Meanwhile, in the B story, Anne and Mark continue to casually date and have dinner at her house. That night, the date goes well until Anne finds out Andy has been living in the pit outside her house this whole time. Classic moment. Although she's angry, eventually Anne and Mark let Andy join them for an awkward dinner to keep him out of the rain. Leslie and Tom butt heads during the competition. Leslie favors the smart and accomplished Susan, while Tom bases his vote on hotness. April quits when she finds out the prize was actually just gift certificates for a fence company. After the contest, the judges deliberate. Tom and the other judges all immediately agree Trish, the quote-unquote hot one, should win. The guy says it's the hot one, literally says it's the hot one, bypassing all of Leslie's efforts for Susan to win. At the end of the episode, Dave the cop finds Leslie at the pageant and asks her again on a date. Although she hesitates, Leslie appreciates when he bumps into Trish without much notice, ignoring the hot one, basically. Later in her office, Leslie makes plans with Dave for a date, and he tries to impress Leslie by showing he's memorized the names of all the female politicians who have pictures up in her office. And that's the episode.
Well, listen, notwithstanding that this episode is virulently anti-hot people, there's a lot of funny stuff in this. I liked when they said they were going to judge the contestants based on talent and poise, and Tom Haverford goes, "Talent and poise? That's the strip club by the VA hospital."
And then he mentions the Glitter Factory, which I believe just keeps coming up again in conversation later and later in the series. But yeah.
Doesn't the Glitter Factory eventually explode? Or am I making that up in my own head?
I don't remember. Greg, do you remember the Glitter Factory exploded? There's something like that. I forget.
Hey, guys. What I believe you're thinking of is the glitter bomb that's going to go off at the Glitter Factory. It's not an actual bomb. And I don't want to give too much away because it's in an upcoming episode. But when it comes to a Pawnee explosion, we do know about the Bread Factory explosion that sent the smell of toast throughout the air, and people said it was quite delicious. So that's what I have for you on that.
The other thing about this episode, it's super funny, but it also is, to me, one of the episodes that encapsulates best kind of where we've grown and changed as a society. Did you notice that? Because it's so much about, you know, like you said, hotness and beauty pageants and all that stuff, and all of that stuff is changing. My thing during this episode is, man, it's Leslie's attitudes in all of these episodes. It's like almost like she's a time traveler because she has the attitudes kind of we have now. She's like, is she from the future? Because everyone else is acting scummy. It's like, man, you can't believe the shit they're doing. It's like even the cameraman like pans down to like ogle a woman. It's like, you can't do that. And Leslie's basically saying you can't do that. But again, it's 2009. And so she's almost having the attitudes that people have now. So
it is. She's very much the avatar of things to come.
Yeah.
In this show.
I think the idea of a beauty pageant in general was such ripe territory because it gets to show all of these characters' attitudes very clearly, right? In the A story, have Leslie, Tom, and April, and you just see, you know, all of them express who they are with this as the setting. And that's a great, that's why, you know, settings are chosen for a reason, right? So you get to see Leslie be a feminist, you get to see her sort of get across what she thinks, you know, women should be judged by. You see April kind of be chaotic and enter just for money and then be really funny as a contestant. And you get to show Tom have his very retrograde attitudes. And so they're all very on character. And when you're early on in a show, a story like this allows you to see who the characters are and be funny.
Was there also a notion that I'm trying to think back to 2009, there was that hilarious moment where some teen Miss beauty pageant girl and she literally could not string sentences together.
So it was partially based on this very specific pageant. It was Miss Teen USA 2007, Miss South Carolina.
People out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and
thank you very much, South Carolina.
By the way, the host, our very own Mario Lopez. I don't know why I said our very own. He doesn't belong to me, but it just seems like he's everybody. He belongs to everybody. He belongs to America. He belongs to the world.
Belongs to the world, truly.
I apologize to you, Miss South Carolina. I know there's a lot of pressure up there, but man, that is. She basically said people don't have maps, and the question was about American education, and I'm reading what we wrote into the script, and it's actually arguably more intelligent than what she said.
So, it's been a long time since I've seen you act. Give me a little, come on.
So the question is, Leslie asks, how can we improve on the great American experiment? And this is what Trish Yanetta says. Well, I think that America is the land of the free, which is a wonderful thing, and also the brave, where people can live. And no one can ever take that away from you, and it never gives up. But the high birthing rate of immigrants frightens me. No offense to anyone out there, but if it were up to me and my family, I would actually call it our America and not their America. Thank you.
So, it's pretty great.
So it's actually more intelligible and more sort of racist, maybe in a vague sense. But yeah,
this is like a little more overt. I like when she comes out for her talent with a baton and Amy's, she's not even twirling it. She's really just stretching with it.
I remember how funny that was. Yeah, I think I got pitched in the writer's room and it was like, oh, this is going to be really funny. And then we just, on the day, I guess they just had her you know, hold the baton and move her body around and did not even throw it in the air. So.
It's actually amazing. And I felt bad for the character that Leslie was advocating for in the sort of 12 Angry Men jury scene, which also made me laugh, that she's the holdout in the jury. And I wondered if that's how it goes in this holdout in the juries, where the one person just keeps asking for a vote, the vote goes against them. What do you do? Then you ask for another vote and the vote goes against you? Like,
it's hilarious, man. I was Like the closest analogy I can make from my personal experience, I was once on a jury for the Tribeca Film Festival, and it was very much like that. You watch all these films, and you go into a room, and you're sequestered. And one of the other jurors was an actress that I actually knew, and she came in real hot. She came in. We all sat down. She's like, "It's gotta be this one. It's this one. Like, it's definitely this one. Like, it's the best movie." And then we went around. We each picked one, right? And then by the end, it was clear that the majority was picking this other one. And we expected this long, protracted fight, like the one in the episode. But it came back around to this actress, and she was like, "Okay, yeah, that's great. We can do that one. Let's go." It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Super unintentional comedy from her, because she was so passionate and she had such a personal connection to this other film. But then it was over immediately. It's like she just wanted to go home, get dinner or something. So it was the opposite of this. But no, in this one, Leslie is just kind of really, really digging her heels in. And yeah, it's the episode's packed because it is like kind of a 12 Angry Men parody in some ways.
I love that it's sort of a forerunner to the Ron Swanson Pyramid of Greatness, which is one of my favorite
classic
things of all time.
That's in an episode that has my name on it. So yeah, that was a fun one.
Oh, Mr. Yeah. Yang, you've created something super special.
I take no credit, but yeah, it's coming up. So yeah.
But the forerunner to that is the checklist that Amy has for who she thinks should win in the categories. And my favorite obscure, it's an actual category super that Leslie Knope has. The Naomi Wolf factor made me laugh out loud. It's such an obscure joke. It's really, really funny.
We did a whole talking head basically for this Naomi. For those of you who don't know, Naomi Wolf, a leading spokeswoman of the third wave of the feminist movement. So she's a journalist, you know, she's the author of The Beauty Myth. But yeah, I mean, putting that in a network comedy is pretty ballsy, right? It's like you're expecting your audience to have sort of this elevated education. So that was kind of funny that's in there.
And this is the difference. If you ever wondered what the difference between a person who went to Harvard, like Alan Yang, and a person who didn't go to college at all, like me, is that when we talk about Naomi Wolf, he gives you that answer. If you ask me about Naomi Wolf, I go, she's the one that told Al Gore to wear more earth colors in his presidential campaign.
Man, that's a good pull. I didn't remember that.
That was her contribution.
Maybe if he had listened, he would have won.
Guys, I thought it'd be fun to call out all of the scorecard categories that Leslie had. I was checking the list. We have teeth, interior life, knowledge of herstory, presentation, intelligence, fruitful gestures, lack of ostentation, je ne sais quoi, the aforementioned the Naomi Wolf factor, voice modulation, and just a section for miscellaneous notes. It's a weird thing on the prop. Je ne sais quoi is actually spelled je ne sais quio, which I think is just silly. But beyond that, I was sort of thinking about our time in the writer's room coming up with these categories, and I definitely agree that this is a precursor, in a way, to the Swanson Pyramid of Greatness, which, Alan, I think you remember we spent maybe several days on.
Yeah.
Much to my happiness, there was a mural moment. Apparently the mural was, I can't believe I'm going to say this. The mural was called A Lively Fisting, if I'm not mistaken.
Got renamed, but what used to be called A Lively Fisting, yes, that is included in the episode somehow.
I like the Dave cop character, the reveal that he's not Amy's intellectual equal. Dave says, "Oh, is that your grandma?" It's Madeline Albright. He goes, "Oh, her name is Madeline Albright?"
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's so good.
I just call my Nana. But yeah, it's... yeah, I mean, and I think the other thing, like watching this episode just takes me back to kind of the different atmosphere in season two in the writer's room, because we had new people in the room. Obviously, Katie Dippold, who wrote this episode, who's gone on to write Ghostbusters and The Heat and, you know, all these movies. She's a big movie writer now. She's writing I think she's writing The Haunted Mansion for Disney now. But we also added Harris Whittles. We added Aisha Muhar. We added Mike Scully. I mean, think about all those writers. They've stayed on for almost the entire run of the show, all of those people. And there's a range, you know, there's young, there's more experienced. They're all super funny and super good energy in the room. And I actually highlighted some of the lines that I could be wrong, but I remember them writing. Like there's a Whittles line that I think it's like, it's Pratt. Like, he wrote a lot of Pratt stuff because he loved writing, like, you know, dumb guy jokes. And he's screaming, like, are we going to talk about anything other than the lies that I told you? Like, that's very Whittles. Like, that's very Harris. Like, that's like, and then there's a joke that we used to call, like, a Scully joke. Like, we literally had a term for it. It's an April talking head. She says, you know, she quits, and then she has a talking head that says, I may not have won, but at least I didn't make any new friendships. And it's like, that is the economy. So Scully, you know, wrote for The Simpsons. He used to run the show and, you know, just super experienced and had the most laser beam focused eye on jokes and economy of words. So he would have a setup and a turn, and it would all happen in 12 words or something. So we used to call some of those like Scully jokes, and sometimes we would try to pitch them, but no one could do it as well as he could. And yeah, he became one of Amy's favorites too. And we ended up putting him in the show. He plays a character named Pearl who sometimes goes to town halls and is just says a one crazy joke and sits down. So he was a great addition to the show. And I want to credit, you know, Katie and Aisha too, because again, I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, but in a show with a female lead, a female friendship as its center, and this one especially, which is a kind of about the male gaze and about a feminist response to that, you know, it helps to have women in the room, and the staff was, I think at this point, probably 50% women, which really helped, and Katie has her name on the script, obviously. So, but Katie and Aisha, both really great with story, really great with jokes, and it was evidenced by, you know, their continuation of their careers. So I could feel those writers. I could feel the fun we were all having in the room. And I actually was talking about this one more quick anecdote. I was in my writer's room yesterday for my new show, and remember, Greg, I wanted to talk to you about this. At a certain point, Greg was in the room. He's a script coordinator, and he became a writer in later seasons. But at the time, what season was it that you started to have sound effects? So in the writer's room, you're talking all the time, and then at a certain point, you play sound effects. At a certain point at Parks and Rec, it was like a morning zoo radio show where everyone had their own theme song and they were running bits. And so I was talking to my co-creator on the show, Matt Hubbard, who came and wrote for Parks season 7. And he said, I came in there and I did not understand anything that was happening. It was a circus because you would walk in and, you know, I would pitch a joke and then Greg would play my theme song and then Harris would pick a joke. He would play it and he would play his theme song and they were running bits. Mike Schur would go off on a rant. You know, I don't, you know, Rob, you've probably heard Mike go off on something political or something about sports or something. Yeah. And Greg would start playing, what would you play, like the Battle Hymn of the Republic or something? It was like ramping up dramatic music and he wouldn't even notice. And then it would start playing and everyone would laugh because it would always diffuse the situation. Right? It was so funny.
What were some of the sound effects that people had, and who's, do you remember who had what theme song?
What were all the theme songs? Like I forget some of them. Oh, Harris's was the Seinfeld theme song. So he would pitch a joke and go, bow, 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 bow. It's like, what is happening?
Yeah, you know, it's when I became a writer after a while, but when I was a script coordinator, writer assistant, you spend a lot of time listening and taking notes, and I wanted to have a voice somehow in the room, and so I realized I could do it with sound effects and bits. And so my favorite first one was I added a doorbell sound whenever someone would come in.
Very mild start, right? You ease your way in, which is funny because like it would also be
but it was a nice way for the room to say, oh, someone's here, I should turn and look at the door. Yang, you were talking about this. I definitely had Battle Hymn of the Republic playing for Mike whenever he would go on a very long rant about something so specific, and you would see everybody's eyes kind of
glaze over
out, and he would slowly rise, and every so often after about 30 seconds he would realize it was playing and turn
to
a look of both disdain and like total comedy appreciation.
Yeah, because that's what it was. I was talking about that, and all the other writers on my new show were like, why did he fire you? I was like, because he was a very tolerant guy. He appreciated them. Oh, another one I love was Morgan Sackett, who was our line producer, who's brilliant, but he would come in, and he's usually going to come in and talk about the budget or something didn't work or whatever. So Greg would play the Star Wars Darth Vader theme, right? Wasn't that?
Yeah, when he would walk in, and then whenever he would speak, I would play the theme song from The Omen.
Yeah, that's another one.
Oh, amazing. And by the way, he's the nicest man in the world, which makes it even funnier.
I know we had Gore on, and my favorite Dan Gore theme song was definitely, it was the Masterpiece Theater.
Yes, because he's a very fancy man.
Wonderful,
he's a very elevated. Yeah.
He's very high-spoken, well-spoken, and he would just say that thing that needed that stinger afterwards. Those are definitely my favorites. And it just kept going to the point that I used to play it out of iTunes, and then I bought myself
an application on my computer that I could play it with the keystroke because they were coming so fast.
It's true madness. Yeah, he had a soundboard app. But I mean, you can imagine that it just takes the it takes the shit out of you, right? It takes the punch out of you if Gore's goes off and talks about the opera or something, like Dan Gore's, like, if, you know, he talks about the opera and then, you know, Greg plays Masterpiece Theater. It's like, yeah, you have a sense of humor about yourself. But yeah,
I want to be in that writer's room.
It's never happened in any of the writer's room. So credit to Greg that I've been in. But yeah, it was very fun. Also, wasted a ton of time, but whatever. It's nice when you've been on a show for that long. And this was basically like later seasons. I mean, when we were sort of, you know, messing around a little more. But man, how fun.
See, I think sound and soundboards are very underutilized. I think they could be brought into so many different worlds. Like on an actual shooting set, it's same as the writer's room in that the hours are long. There's a lot of time thinking, a lot of time waiting, and then it's punctuated by a certain amount of actual acting and action. Mike Myers on Austin Powers used soundboard, and it was the greatest thing ever. Like, we would be sitting around waiting for the camera to be set up, and Mike would just kind of and I never knew how the sound guy knew. And Mike would like raise his finger, and you'd hear the beginning of Car Wash.
How did he know?
So it went. So you'd hear, and that clapping beginning of Car Wash was the kind of, okay, let's go. Anytime you're ready, we're ready to do. Like, that's whenever it was a little bit of boredom, Car Wash would play, and then there were other sound things, and I don't know how they had like an ESP thing going on. It was one of the most fun, cool things ever. The other thing I think about is you as a baseball fan, Alan. You know, people have walk up songs.
Yes.
In certain stadiums, a player has a song to walk up to. So this is really, it's all the same conversation. Yeah, I'm always thinking, what would be your walk-up
that's
song?
That's so funny. I remember reading about other people's walk-up songs, and it's usually like, you know, it's a mix like really hard hip-hop or like a country song or something. And then I remember Hideki Matsui was a Japanese player, and he would come up to Clocks by Coldplay, just like the softest song, like not even trying to. I was like, that's really intimidating for the pitchers. Like, oh my god, Chris Martin's coming up to bat. But that always made me laugh. I was like, why did he choose that song? It's so funny.
That's really funny.
That's really funny, man. Yeah, I don't know. I guess you have to go with something hard, right? You know, I don't know. What would you pick?
What was Alan's theme song? Greg, we didn't get Alan's theme song.
Oh yeah, I don't know the name of it. It was just like kind of something with like some weird. He would play when I did pull ups. It was like kind of like a weird swaggery song or something. It was like a jazzy, like Tin Pan Alley weird thing. Yeah, it stuck for years, which is so funny.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Plus, you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, which is awesome, and more than 60 add-ons every week.
The last Factor meal I had was a pork chop. Oh, here's the thing about pork chops. I want it tender. I want it juicy. And that is what Factor gave me. Honest to God, it was amazing. And all I had to do was peel off the top and pop it in the oven a couple of minutes. And the smell hits you before you ever taste it. It fills the entire kitchen. And then you peel and you eat. And it is so good.
Head to factormeals.com/parksandrecs50 and use code parksandrecs50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code parksandrecs50 at factormeals.com/parksandrecs50. 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from BreezeLine. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at BreezeLine.com.
You know, the B story is interesting because we're putting chess pieces into position, right? We're putting them into place. I think there's an Andy and Mark sort of love triangle going on. And I think, You know, I think we were figuring out what we had in Pratt, which is this secret weapon who's super likable. And like, we're like, maybe we shouldn't make him a super unlikable character when he's a super likable guy. So he has kind of a cute moment at the end. He's living in that tent. I thought it was just so adorable when he's like, he has that talking head and he, you know, he's like, I thought that went pretty well. And it's raining all around him and he's in, clearly in a bad situation. But he's positive, right? And that's, you know, we're adjusting the character in that situation.
That moment where he reveals, like, sticks his head out of the pit back in like a gopher, is just a really, really funny sight
gag. Yeah, and it's a precursor to a lot of physical gags he would do, right? I mean, you've seen him on like roller skates, you see him jumping over a counter, you see him falling down, you see. So yeah, that he does his own stunts. So yeah, there was a lot of that, which is good. And you know, I think they're even trying to mark, you know, I say they, we were even trying to make Mark more likable, right? It's like in this one, he's just more normal. He's just kind of a straight man. He's no longer like trying to sleep with everybody. So I think it's just kind of adjusting these characters and turning the dial on them to make the show work and find the tone.
You know, something I actually wanted to quickly call out as we are talking about Andy's character. You know, we've discussed the first six episodes, the show was figuring itself out. The writing staff, the actors, everyone was figuring out what this show was going to be. But one of the original intentions of the series by Greg and Mike was for Andy and for Chris Pratt to only be on the show for the first six episodes, right? Andy was supposed to help introduce Anne and the pit in this comic way, but then leave. And so what became so clear to everybody was that not just was Andy a great character, but Chris Pratt is this, you know, once in a generation comic talent. And so when he stayed on as a series regular, I actually think that these first few episodes of the season, of this second season, is the writing staff figuring out, okay, then who is Andy going to be if not for, you know, a short storyline? What is his character going to be? What will his comic traits and his failings and his interesting qualities going to be? And so you see so much of Andy in these first few episodes because it was a chance now to really expand on his character. So I always love that about the beginning of the season. I just wanted to call that out to you guys right here.
The editing is a comedy masterclass in Parks and Recreation. But you can see in this episode that they're starting to learn some of the lessons that really make it hilarious. Like there's a jump cut sequence in the middle of the talent show bit in the beauty pageant. And so here, you can imagine the setup is you're going to have the old lady contestant who's clearly old. She's old, old. And you're like, what the hell? And she's going to sing the Donna Summer song. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's so good. Like, so that's funny. Okay, I told it. Everybody, right, that's funny. But what you don't do is say, and now the old contestant will show you her talent. And then you don't know what she's going to do. She stands up. You know what's going to happen. And she clears her throat. And she starts to sing this. That's not how it's done on Parks and Recreation. Out of nowhere, you cut into, not even the beginning, in the middle of one of the, oh, it's so good, it's so good. It's like a math jigsaw puzzle scientific bit of editing. When you think about how that could have been shot, could have been edited, and then how it was edited, and it's genius.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up that specific moment because to me, that is a great example of everything coming into place. And they say a movie or a show is made three times, essentially. It's made in the writing. It's made in the shooting when you're on set, and then it's made again in the editing room. And they all have to work in concert, and each one can be additive or each one can be subtractive or deleterious to the process, right? So in that specific case, when I hear that song, I think of Katie Dipple because she would always pitch someone singing that song. I remember her pitching that and writing it into the script. And wouldn't it be funny if you see all these young women and then you just see an older lady singing this song out of nowhere? You don't even see her beforehand, right? It's surprising and it's funny, and that's what comedy is, right? It's something unexpected, and so I'm glad you flagged that moment.
Comedy is so subjective, as we all know, and people talk about what smart comedy is or isn't. What you just described is smart comedy because there is no setup. Like, this is just joke, and the setup is left up to the audience to be smart enough to figure out.
Yeah, I think there's always a fundamental respect for the audience and the audience's intelligence and the audience getting something unexpected. And I do remember, you know, I think the people making the show, you know, Mike and Greg and all the actors were really smart people. But I do think that sometimes they got annoyed. Like, certainly Mike got annoyed. I think we were on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. You know, all you guys are on the cover, you know, the cast of the show. And it said, the smartest comedy on television. And Mike was like, it would be nice if it said the funniest comedy or the best comedy, right? Because we don't want people to think, like, you got to have a PhD to watch the show. But, you know, I agree with you in the sense that it doesn't pander, right? It's not trying to pander. It's not trying to go lowest common denominator. And I think that's a common thread through a lot of the stuff that Mike has worked on and hopefully that I've worked on as well.
Yeah, my favorite thing about, I remember shooting that Entertainment Weekly cover, is we do all these different photos, and the headline that they clearly want to use and did is the smartest comedy on television, and yet the picture they use is all of us with a gigantic stuffed bear in the background for no reason.
Yeah, that was one of them, and then the other one was you guys like in a Jeep or something. Like, and remember that one? Like, that was on the covers. Like, you guys were wearing like safari outfits or something? I don't know.
We were in the desert, and I was doing a parody of Franco and 2.5 hours or 300.5 days where he got his arm caught in a rock and had to saw it off. Remember that movie? That
was like, remember that one? 127 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. That was like that was big movie at the moment. So if you ever look at that Entertainment Weekly and look it up, I'm in James Franco's exact wardrobe.
How strange.
With little tiny rocks, tiny ones on top of my arm.
Do you ever do a photo shoot and you look at what the photographer wants you to do and you're like, I'm not going to do that? Because I think they come up with weird ideas. Because like, I feel like they always, to me, not like I've done nearly as many photo shoots as you have, but I often feel like it seems like they're doing this photo shoot for you, not for me. You want to add something weird to your portfolio. You don't want to do something normal.
Oh, all the time. And I also find that they, with quote-unquote comedy
material, the worst
is the worst.
Yeah, can you wear like a fake glasses with a fake nose, or like hold up a banana to your ear and pretend it's a telephone, like that kind of shit? Like,
it's the worst. I mean, even Annie Leibovitz, who's one of the greatest photographers in the world and one of my personal favorites, has a picture of Ellen DeGeneres in, wait for it, clown shoes and a clown outfit, and of course she's the sad clown.
Yeah, there you
because
go.
You know, there's only one type. All clowns are actually sad. We know that.
Oh man, the curse of the comedy performer, right? You like the respect you want to get. It's like they want to put you in this box and put you in funny clothes, goofy glasses, all that stuff. But that, I think that's why a lot of comedians, like, they want to do like their serious movie. I literally think that's to avoid photo shoots like that. They want to do something serious.
That's the only reason they do it.
I was doing some photo shoot for the Hollywood Reporter, some roundtable thing for showrunners or something, and we walked into this room, and it looked like the set of Saved by the Bell in 1989. It was all pastel, you know, giant foam shapes and like, you know, pinks and light greens, seafoam greens and light blues, and like a checkerboard floor, and we all of us were kind of like, wait, what is this? And it was like, you know, it was like Bill Hader and Gerard Carmichael, Dave Mandel, and at one point Hader was so funny, he's like, you want me to sit on this giant ball? Like, it's just like the funny, like, anyway, like, you can pull up the photos of him. He's like has his head in like a circle, and like, that's what they made us do. We did it, but it's like, again, like, you know, they're just trying to do their jobs and do something interesting, but it's certainly, Hader was so funny. He's like, I don't know, what is this? He was so, because he doesn't care, but it was very funny, man.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Jim, question for you. How is your social battery right now? You drained? Are you bursting with energy? How you doing?
My battery, Greg, thank you for asking, is pretty full. It's because I've learned over the years, sometimes you got to get help, and I am not afraid to do that.
It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. So it's important to figure out what the right amount of socializing for you is and the best way to recharge. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Well, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Yeah, so if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It can be a lifesaver. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, because, you know, sometimes the first match isn't always the best match.
So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/parks today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/parks. parks.
Doers, mowing season is here with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
All right, you want to take a step inside the Pawnee Town Hall? Where are we doing the town hall today? You want to do it in the gym? You want to do it in the pool? Where do you want to do it? The pool? I don't know.
I think we should do it. It's hot out today as we're recording this, so I think we should do it at the band shell.
Oh, that's
outdoor
nice.
At the band shell.
Wow, that's lovely. That's like a great place for a town hall. Might encourage too many people to come and ask questions that I don't want to answer.
That's right.
Nico from New Jersey. This question is kind of for both of us. What season of Parks and Rec was the most fun to make and why? Which one was the trickiest? Thank you, Nico, for the question.
Mm. You want to lead that one off?
I will. So a lot of thoughts. You know, for as far as the most fun to make, I feel like the process might not have been the most fun, but the one, it's to me, it's between 2 and 3 because we were finding our groove, and like that's when the show, to me, there's a sweet spot in a show, certainly coming from it from a writing perspective and probably from a performer's perspective as well. You know, you tell me. But when you're first starting out, you're finding your footing. You're finding who the characters are. You're discovering who they are. There's a joy in that. But then at a certain point, you reach, to me, like a nice plateau where you know who they are and you're hitting on their jokes. It's like, oh, I get it. Ron Swanson is the manliest guy in the world. So that's fun. Then you do that for a while. And then if you're on a show like this, which has to run many, many seasons, or if you're lucky enough to run many, many seasons, you're confronted with a choice. Do I either repeat the same jokes and stories over and over again, or do I change the characters completely and make them unrecognizable? And that's when it gets difficult, right? That's when it becomes, I think there's, again, some meme on the internet where it's like season one character is a normal, season two is like a little bit more interesting, and then season 9, it's like, it's a cartoon, right? It's like, you don't know, it's Ron Swanson just, you know, waking up and eating a whole cow or something, right? You just don't, like, yeah. How many jokes can we do about bacon, right? How many jokes, like, we get it, he's manly, but you're in that position, right? You've done 100 stories, and people, keep in mind, like, sometimes we have A, B, and C stories on each episode, so that might be, you might be on story number 370, right? It's not even 120, it's a 300 stories with these characters. Anyway, I'm going to say season 3. That includes the Harvest Festival arc. That's you guys, you know, Chris and Ben joining the show, you and Adam, and that's when it felt like, man, this is really hitting on all cylinders. And so, yeah, that was, and I'll answer, why don't you answer that one, and I'll do the other one, which one was the trickiest after you.
The shooting schedule was unlike any I've ever been on. Like, you do 6 episodes, and then you'd shut down for 9 months, and then you come back and do 320 in a row, so you could shut down for another 9. It was, like, insane. So I never know what season was what because of that. But I will say that when we knew that it was going to be my last season and Rashida's last season, there was such a great nostalgia, and it was like senioritis. It was like you'd graduated. It was all fun and games, and you were just enjoying every minute of everybody's company, because you knew you'd never have anything like this, quite like this again. That's what that last season
senior
was.
Spring, kind of, it's just fun. Everyone having a good time. A show that we felt like was working, and we also saw the finish line in some ways, right? That was really helpful. And I always feel like that helps the writing as well as the performing. But yeah, and Rob's not joking. I mean, because of a variety of factors, some of which was Amy, you know, having kids and stuff, season 2/3 ended up being 30 episodes in a row or something. It was so bizarre. It was so many episodes in a row. It's an inhuman number of episodes to do in a row. Anyone who's working in the industry knows that, but we got through it. And I think we ended up with some really great creative stuff. I think as far as which one was the trickiest, to me, you know, obviously season one is always tricky because you're building the world and you're building the characters and you're figuring out how your actors perform best. It also, to me, gets a little tricky, as I said, later on in the run, but before the end. So to me, like, the last season is kind of cool. It's like, you know, we're ending and, like, you know, you're writing towards an end point. This is where we're going. This is... But if you don't know that, if you're, you know, people on long-running shows, like season 12, like that to me starts getting hard, where it's episode 17 of season 12, you're like, oh my God, it's like, you know, like Chris and Ron fight over a stapler or something. Like, you're just trying to, yeah, I don't know, man, like we gotta make an episode, right? We gotta shoot on Monday, so we gotta figure this out. So that, but I will say this, you know, those later seasons that you were talking about, Rob, like one of the fun things for me was I started getting a little bit, you know, Mike started trusting me to help run the room. So that was really exciting for me. So the later seasons, you know, Mike was working on Brooklyn a little bit and Brooklyn Nine-Nine with Dan. And so Dan was gone. And so I was helping to run the room with Donna Carey, who was another writer. And so me being able to, as a younger writer, getting able to sit at the keyboard and make some decisions and sort of decide what goes in the script was really exciting for me. And I'm always grateful to Mike for that experience.
Well, this was a great episode, and I thank you guys for downloading, listening. Make sure that you subscribe to the show, and like I say, tell two friends about it, and that math works out to be a lot of audience very, very, very quickly. They tell me. I don't know. I didn't go to Harvard. Does that math make sense?
There's still time. They're still accepting people, and give us high ratings. We need validation. And that's the show. Thanks to producer Greg and producer Schulte. Goodbye from Pawnee.
See you next week.
This episode of Parks and Recollection is produced by Greg Levine and me, Rob Schulte. Our coordinating producer is Lisa Berm. The podcast is executive produced by Alan Yang for Alan Yang Productions, Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Jeff Ross, Adam Sachs, and Joanna Solitaroff at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson at Stitcher. Gina Batista, Paula Davis, and Britt Kahn are our talent bookers. The theme song is by Mouse Rat, a.k.a. Mark Rivers, with additional tracks composed by John Danick. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Parks and Recollection.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best Eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best Eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.